Hello and welcome to Towards the Point, a cultural compass for Pompey and beyond. I'm James Sandy, and in this special programme we focus on the work of Hampshire-based poet Robin Bolam. We consider creative responses to industrial change and decline across the country, and we dust off the wax cylinders for a quick reminder about April's Record Store Day. And, if that's not enough, we catch up on some local events for you yourselves to explore. Joining me as ever is the Bard of the Beach, the Lyre on the Minstrel's Elbow, and no stranger to the prose of prose, it's the young Dave Allen.
Who said I'm a liar?
And we are also joined by our very special guest, Robin Bolam, who was born in Newcastle, grew up in Northumberland, and now lives in Hampshire. Her poetry collections, published by Blood Axe, are The Peep Show Girl, Raiding the Borders, and New Wings, Poems 77 to 2007. She's editor of Eliza's Babes, Four Centuries of Women's Poetry in England, 15th to 19th centuries, on Blood Axe, and her poems appear regularly in anthologies, magazines, locally and nationally and internationally. And now, Robin, welcome to Towards the Point.
Thank you. It's very nice to be here.
It's great to have you here. We first met at a Tongues and Grooves event in the Square Tower in Old Portsmouth, and we thought we'd get you back on. We had a few technical issues, but we wanted to explore your work more deeply. So we're really pleased to have you on the show. Dave and I think, are fairly new to poetry. It's something that we're dabbling with, or at least I am. Although Dave did have a moment, I think, when we went to that festival. If not a cup of tea and a few buns.
Well, I bought that anthology of Portsmouth poetry, which I enjoyed very much.
He's still thumbing his way through it. So, Robin, if we can start by... we always ask sort of artists and musicians these kind of questions, but how did you get into poetry? What pulled you into poetry?
I don't know what pulled me in. Maybe my grandmother.
Okay.
Because I can't remember before writing it, but then I was just small, and you little kids love rhymes, and I had a grandmother who told stories, so that was how I got into it, I suppose. She was wonderful in that she made things up all the time. She had a book of, well, I think it was the Complete Shakespeare, that tiny print tissue paper stuff, and she would read that, and I was quite old before I realised that they were plays, because she'd tell them as stories. But of course a lot of them are in verse anyway, so I think it was that maybe got me started. And just the fact that, you know, when you're a child, you write stuff for your parents, you write, you know, little cards at birthdays and things, and I did that sort of thing, and then found I just was writing poems because I liked doing it, and I've never really changed. When I was sort of a teenager, I was doing it really as well.
And what is it you get from poetry? What does poetry give you? I read, I know it's last time that we met, you said that it kind of makes you feel healthier and happier. It's got to be a good thing, isn't it?
Well, if you don't, I think the reverse of that is if you don't do it, if I don't write for a while, then I don't feel so healthy and happy, and that's not so good. So it's always better to be trying to write. I think the thing is that it helps you express your feelings and your responses to what's happening around you. So if you can be connected in that way, it's an imaginative connection, but it's a, you know, it's something creative, and it makes you feel part of life, even if you're making, you know, a creative response to it. It's still, there's something real there at the heart of it. And that's how that...
You make it sound wonderfully easy to me. And I would confess that, I did at English A-level, so I read Keats and stuff, and never really figured it out much, because at the time I was listening to Bob Dylan, or, you know, and that was better for me.
So, I'm sure there's a connection between Keats and Bob Dylan.
I'm sure, yeah. Well, yeah, but it was... I've always struggled to find my way into it. The thing that was striking me here was, when I was a kid, I drew. Mm. So I ended up being an artist, you know, an art teacher and so on. So it was the same, but I didn't write poems and things. What you make sound easy is coming to terms with the form. But you must have done that somehow. Now, did you just find that out, or did people teach you? You
know, no, I think it's the music. I wasn't aware of form when I, you know, no. when I was little.
No.
You if things rhyme, you know later on, you know that's a couplet or a rhyming couplet or whatever it is. But when you're a child, you just like the sound of the rhyme, and I think you hear the music. You hear it perhaps as beats or as a sort of little tune.
Right.
And so if I can write a poem that's got a little bit of rhythm in it, that's, you know, the musical quality, then I think it works. If it doesn't have that music, I can have the best idea for me, and it falls flat. Sylvia Plath used to say they were stillborn, the sorts of poems that you try and breathe life into, but they don't live.
Mm.
And I think you can try too hard sometimes. You can do a lot of research if you've got a great idea, but it won't work unless you've got the music in it.
But was there a point where, I mean, for example, you discovered Sylvia Plath and from that learned some things about form that you'd never realised before? Because that happened to me with art, you know. I mean, you suddenly, you know, at a certain age, you draw and draw and draw, realist, if you like, and then suddenly somebody shows you Picasso's cubism and you think, I can't make head nor tail of that. And a year later, it all goes, absolutely fits into place, and your work takes off as a consequence. Did that happen for
well,
you?
Well, discovered Sylvia Plath, yes, at school. Right. And I think there's good and bad about that. She was a wonderful poet, but she was also perhaps a bit dangerous. You know, you can read too much Sylvia Plath at an early age. And I ended up having to write a poem to exercise her, you know, almost taking bits of her poems and you know, working through them so that I didn't end up on that dangerous route to where she went. You know, there was a sense as a teenager it would be very compelling, really.
You mean where she went personally?
Yes, I mean, yeah. Her poetry was self-destruct, you know, it was about self-destruction in some ways. It was wonderful poetry, and the things, some of the ones she wrote about her children were fantastic. Yeah. But there's also that self-destructive urge that she had, you know, that when you're a teenager, you can pick up on all of those sort of ideas. And it was, I felt it was a bit dangerous. I felt it was almost a lure. And so I tried to break out of that, probably about 15, I think I wrote this poem. And I had a hatchet job, really, on some of Plath's poems, taking out my favourite phrases and putting them together and reworking them into my poem in order to say, you know, this is me, not you, and I'm not going to go the same way, you know, and I'm not anywhere, like, as good as you, but I don't mind. I just want to do my poems, yeah, not your poems.
So that's almost a collage.
It was a bit of a collage. Yeah. I think this is what you do. You read other people's poems in order to find you know, your voice, I suppose. Yeah, yeah. But you read them to gain experience of different kinds of things, and you can put a lot of different things together and get something new. Mm-hmm. When in poetry, there's nothing ever really new in language. You can discover old language, you can find dialect, you can find you know, sort of the vocabulary of different things like cricket or whatever, and you can make a poem of it, and it's interesting because other people won't have heard those words. But in the end, I think it's the combinations of words that are interesting, not the fact that you can invent. That's not as important, perhaps, as putting things that everybody's heard together in ways they haven't heard. So you startle people, you surprise them.
I like the idea of cricket, don't I? Did you
there
know?
Are cricket poems.
Did you know I like the idea of cricket?
Dave's quite
I
a cricket fan.
It.
I am a serious cricket lover, yeah. So, and there are indeed poems about cricket. Alan Ross has written, John Arlott wrote poems about cricket, yeah.
Yeah.
Alan Ross wrote a quite beautiful one about cricket at Hove, yeah.
Alan Ross was a very lovely man.
Ah,
he used to edit things from his shed in the garden, didn't he? London Magazine. Yeah.
In some of your biog, you say that you're very often writing kind of in a persona, you know, kind of, I suppose, in a slightly different mode than from yourself. I'm quite interested in that because we were talking just before we started recording about how different artists have a different vocal or a different sound or a different voice. And I wonder, kind of, in the majority of your work, are you writing in it as a different person, or are you writing to find the person you are?
I wish it was that simple. I think when I started off, this is very, very rough generalisation, but when I started off, I think I made most things up. Hmm. In other words, I was using persona all the time, really, which confused a lot of people, including my mum. She'd never quite got the hang of this, that one poem I might be a laburnum tree and the next one I would be somebody totally different, or an old woman, or, you know. Once I wrote a poem called Second Wife and people actually thought I was on my second marriage, and I was about 20 at the time, so, and, you know, it just threw them. But it was this sense of going into another experience and imagining it. But often I started with a real emotion, because I don't think it works if nothing's true, and I don't really go along for the just write what you know, because you can, and that works very well. But if you limit yourself to that, then you are a bit restricted. I even know people who say, I'm saving all of the personal things you know, for later, because that's me and I'll be giving too much of myself away. A bit like the idea that if you let someone take your photograph, you've lost a bit of your soul. And they say everything's made up, therefore I keep myself safe. I don't really go along with that entirely. Initially, I felt it was fine if I had a real emotion and I could just put it into a new context. So if I felt lonely or if I felt, you know, a particular emotion, I would imagine a character who used that emotion, you know, expressed that emotion, but in a very different context. Sometimes it would be a character from Shakespeare, sometimes it would be a tree. You know, it doesn't really matter. I think the tree came from Ovid's Metamorphoses because it was a woman who turned into a tree. But there were all sorts of different things like that. Even a peep show girl in Berlin, that was where the title of the first book came from, was someone who did that job. And that was somebody I knew through a friend. But I pretended it was me in the poem because I was trying to think of how I would survive in a situation where I had to use my imagination to get me through it.
Are there ever occasions, I mean, I don't want to pry particularly into your personal history, but are there ever occasions when the intensity of your emotional state, and I guess it's particularly an unhappy state, that the immediacy and intensity of it is too much for you to actually transport that into some formal piece of artwork? Because it has been the case with me as a singer. There have been times when I've thought, this is going to be a perfect opportunity to excise all those demons, and actually the reverse happened and I couldn't do it and I had to wait 6 months to be outside the thing slightly.
Yes, you're right. Sometimes it's a protection mechanism.
Yes.
And it's strange in a way, because when I first started writing and did all this persona poetry, my life was quite good. You know, it was nothing much bad. You know, not a lot of bad things had happened. Some had. I lost my father when I was quite young, so that was one of the things I didn't write about directly. Yeah. I did it once, and it upset my mother, so I didn't publish that poem for another 20 years. And then I published two together 20 years apart, but they came up in the same book. As if this is why you should never trust the date on the book, because sometimes people collect things and they can't publish it at the time they write it. They have to wait for the right time. But as I went through my life, I found that it was going in phases. So the persona poems were the first one. I was making most things up. And then as I went through, until I got to New Wings, by the time I was there, the New Wings part of that book, a lot of those were true. And I'd gone the full circle almost. Now I'm not sure where I am. I think I'm standing back and trying to, you know, look objectively through the middle somehow, put the personal side there, but also the observer. And I'm not doing so many persona things now. But I think everybody's different, and you go through different phases in any career, any writing career.
Okay, well, we're going to start now, very excitingly. One of four readings that you're going to do for the programme. And the first one's called Raiding the Borders. Do you want to just give us a bit of context for that?
Yes, well, I come from Northumberland, and it's called Raiding the Borders because there were border raiders in my ancestry. And this is a story that basically tells, in a nutshell, a bit of the family history. And I think, apart from that, there's a few things, like the Percys were the Dukes of Northumberland, because my family, when they ended up in the village where I grew up, they always rented the same house for 200 years from the Duke of Northumberland. And that's where it says the home the Percys gave them, because that's who it was. Apart from that, there's things like Limmer and Lammas, but that's just, I think most people would know that. It gives a sense of going back in time. Raiding the Borders. Limmer thieves from robber towers, the reavers rode after Lammas, when nights were longest, horses stronger. Sometimes those they sought to plunder saw the fires lit in warning, heard the fray bell, were prepared. Centuries later, feuds were buried, families allied to survive. As my mother met my father, back through the Bolams and the Halls, Rutherfords and Burnses further north, marriages crossed over borders. When they came down from the shires, the old halls settled by the Tyne, in a home the Percys gave them. Walls yard deep like a stronghold, for the proud hill a proud cottage, and we stayed 200 years. The line grew through generations. 6 children, 9, then 11. Grandmother, the eldest daughter, a widow at 27. 60 years without her husband, taught me how to live with borders. When she crossed, I could not follow, but learnt how silent some raids were. By 20, I knew treachery. A friend, a sister, was stolen in the dark months of winter. Then, after a long siege, my father. We're never free from borders. My mother died on an ocean, shores at its reaches, no fixed limits. Just sea reclaiming, then retreating. The house was empty of all it guarded. Another raid had been unexpected. We meet now on debatable land, neither south nor north, but beyond both. And in those moments, everywhere is full of her. The sky, the sun, as it falls by an open door. She's before me throughout the house. In the air, I feel her pity for the way we let rooms trap us. The need we have to put up walls and defend them. The fear we make for each other by warring raids which haste us to that last border. When I surrendered their old home, I dreamt one night they all came back, waved to me walking down the path. 5 generations who had striven to keep the house their parents left them. If we can't defend, we are forgiven.
Tell us about some of the things you're doing next, because unlike bands, poets don't really tour, do they? Do you do tours or gigging or that kind of thing? Dave, you probably know more about this than I do.
What about? I know more about gigging. Oh, I don't know anything about poems.
You do poetry festivals, poetry readings and that sort of thing. At the moment, I'm going to be doing one in September at the Winchester Poetry Festival. It's a new poetry festival, very exciting, in Winchester in September. And I think Friday the 12th, I'll be on there. Also, Havant has a literature festival in October, and I'll probably be involved with the Spring Poets in that one. And apart from that, we haven't really sort of sorted things out for the summer period yet. I'm just enjoying the summer when it's just arrived.
There's still time. And there are more things that you can find out about Robin and her work on her website, which is www.robinbolam.com. We will, of course, link to our blog, which is towardsthepoint.blogspot.com. You are listening to Towards the Point with me, James Sandy, Dave Allen, and our very special guest, the poet Robin Bolam. Now, part of the reason we asked Robin onto the show was we're very interested in this idea of arts, and poetry in particular, as a response, a cultural response to a happening such as industrial change or industrial decline. One of the topics that we were toying with over the last few weeks was the change to kind of shipbuilding in Portsmouth. You know, the fact that ships aren't going to be built here anymore. There's still a maritime and a marine industry, and there's a whole kind of servicing and maintenance industry around them, but physically building ships in Portsmouth isn't going to happen anymore. And I think they've built ships here since Dave was a lad, at least the 8th century or something like that. So, but Robin, you, a lot of your work kind of touches on this, and this is something you've been involved with before.
Well, some of the recent things I've been writing are linked in with the Newcastle shipyards closing, because that is part of my personal history. And when you get to a certain age, I've discovered, you go back and start writing about your childhood and catching up the gap in between. So that was one of the things I was interested in. But there are lots of responses to industrial change generally, I think, rather than, as well as poetry. I mean, we were talking about the film about the shipyards, the songs of the shipyards, which is a history of shipyards and folk music. But also in art, there was the miners. I think Dave was just before we started talking about that too. And on the Northumbrian coast, there was a group of miners who are still an art gallery there now, as a tribute to them and their work. And so it doesn't have to be poetry; it can be any form of artistic expression. But poetry probably is the thing that most people might do most easily, in the sense that you only need a piece of paper, a pencil and a thought.
I think that's a bit like saying with a guitar, you only need to kind of strum it a little bit. and keep vague rhythm. Mind you, some bands, I think, get away with that, don't they, as we know. But
it's the emotion, you see. I think if people have a very strong passion, then it could easily turn into a poem. Mm. And you don't need to have written one before. Mm. Obviously, there is a sort of sense of mystique about this, but it has to have a music about it, and it won't live if you don't have some passion in it, I think. Mm. So if you feel very strongly about something, if it's about a connection with a place or, as in this case, a tradition, really, something that has gone on a long time, it probably links into families, and it's both the place and it's the work and it's got the family connection, then when a shipyard closes, there is a loss. Well, there's lots of losses, really. It's not just the financial thing. It's to do with security. It's to do with history. It's to do with all sorts of family memories. And it could go two ways, really. You could either write a protest, or you could write something which preserves the memory and it turns into a kind of elegy. But whichever way you go, you're writing your response to what's happened. And sometimes that is a very good thing for the person who's writing to do. And often it will connect people as well.
For me, there are kind of two fascinating things there. One is that question about whether poetry is the most natural thing, and I think there are quite strong arguments for that. And when I first met you, when we met last time, which was just before Christmas, and we were talking about this, it was around the time that I'd been to the first of the rallies and protests in the Guildhall Square about the closure. In a sense, it's nothing to do with me, because I've never had any family in the dockyard. I'm not a shipbuilder, and so on, but I just felt quite strongly about it. And if I think about that now, how did that manifest itself around the city? And it manifested itself entirely in words. There were people on the Guildhall steps, and there were mothers with children who were wives of workers, and there were the workers, and there was the trade union guys, and there were politicians, and they were all making speeches. And then after that, they went inside, and there was Dimbleby and Question Time and a panel talking about it, and there were people asking questions. And then you'd buy the paper, and there were politicians making statements, and then there were letters in the letter page. So it was all words. Everything that came out of it was words. Now, one of the disappointments for me about it was that everything was posed in that kind of classic, contemporary, rational politics speak. Mm. It never went beyond that. So that everybody was comfortable with the idea of words. Nobody made a musical response to it that I'm aware of. I didn't go on all the marches, and maybe people beat drums and things. But I remember in the early 60s, one of the things that characterised the CND marches, which were not that far north of here, to Aldermaston, was there was always jazz bands. There were always people with banjos and trumpets and trombones and drums and a particular form of music, which was that kind of British, but it was essentially American in its origins. So there was a musical response as well as a spoken response. Down here, apart from photographs of the protests, which are in the paper, which is a bit of a visual response, but not much, there haven't been many pictures of people actually building ships that I can remember. It's all been words. So the interesting thing for me is that there are all those words. And as you were suggesting earlier, actually all you kind of need to do is start rearranging those words and changing the form of them. And they move from being merely often the rhetoric of political debate, which is pretty empty on the whole, I mean, if the politicians are going to do something, get on and do it. Stop talking, just do it, get away from that. And that hasn't happened in Portsmouth, which I think is maybe a bit sad. I'm not sure. At the time when we met, I said to you, I think maybe it's too raw and too close and so on. I think it's drifted away.
Well, I don't know. I think maybe it's still early days yet. I think people are probably still in shock in some ways, and they haven't made all their decisions, and they don't know really what they necessarily have to decide. I might be wrong, but wasn't David Cameron saying not that long ago he was trying to keep shipbuilding in Portsmouth somehow or other?
There are proposals.
And they don't know necessarily exactly what that involves yet. And then there's the offers to go to Canada and have a new life there, which is fairly drastic.
Yeah.
It might appeal to people who haven't got so many ties, but it's a very drastic thing to do. Lots of opportunities. But perhaps all of these things are just it's too soon yet. And once people have made their decisions, whatever they are, if they have decisions that they can make, then that will be the time to reflect. And I think it's in the reflection where the poetry will probably come. Because unless it's a protest, which, as you're saying, perhaps the time for that is sort of, well, I don't know if it's gone, but it's the initial protests are certainly gone. Then they have to wait till they know where they're going, and then they can reflect on, you know, what hasn't happened or what has happened, and they can make a response to that. It could happen yet. Every situation is different.
Yes.
And I think the last time we met also, because I'm going to read a poem that links in with the Australian bushfires, I think I mentioned there was a response to that by people in Melbourne, well, that area of Australia that was hit by what they call Black Saturday in 2009, when all these really tremendous fires destroyed a large part of the country. And out of that came a response from some writers called the Murrindindi Writers at Alexandra. And I think in Victoria, and they actually still meet. And if you go in, you can see their website, that they still get together and do this. But they produced something called Nature's Odyssey, which was a response from artists and poets and short story writers. Most of them had never written before, I think. Some of the artists were professional artists, but a lot of the others hadn't done these things before. And they did it as a response because they wanted to do something creative as a healing thing. And it worked for them. They had a professional writer who came in pretty close to when the fires had ended. And they produced the book about 2 years later. I think they were doing the workshops almost immediately afterwards because the community had been destroyed. They'd lost all their familiar sites. There were a few houses left, but an awful lot of the shops and the post offices and a lot of houses had just gone. And the community stayed there. They went back and rebuilt it. And the forest, of course, the landscape regenerated. That's a bit different to what happens in an industrial situation because it's not necessarily going to regenerate. It could turn into something else. I mean, in Newcastle, they now say Swan Hunters does designs ships, engineers, whatever, but it's not the same. And presumably at Portsmouth, if the shipbuilding isn't kept on in some form or other, it'll be different. And even if it is kept on, it won't necessarily be the military side.
No.
So it's going to be different then.
That's changed dramatically.
It's going to have an effect on the way people do sort of come to terms with it, I think.
And I mean, that's something I said earlier, that I'm not a part of that world. My family have not worked there, but when I grew up here in the 1950s, you were totally conscious of the presence of the Royal Navy, because it was still the time of national service. It was only 10 years after the war, when I was 5 or 6 years old. The sailors would walk about town in uniform. They were required to. And it was not until the difficulties with Irish terrorism on the mainland that they stopped doing that. So it didn't matter, really. I mean, I remember summer coming because the sailors' hats would change from black to white, and it would really cheer me up because the cricket season was coming. So it didn't matter, really, whether you were involved in it or not, because it's a small island. It's the only island city in the UK. You just knew about the Navy, everything about it. And there were ships everywhere, battleships and cruisers and destroyers, and all of that has gone away. So this is just, in a sense, this is the final nail, and there have been a lot of nails in the coffin. There is a sense in which you can say this is an opportunity for it to redefine itself, and to become something other than it has been for hundreds of years,
Yes, that does happen. I mean, a place I stayed for a while was Sweden, and they, I think, had a similar, well, not similar, but they had this experience of the shipbuilding closing down. I think in the early 70s, Sweden was probably next to Japan or, somewhere like that. It was one of the biggest in Europe at shipbuilding. And by about 1985, every shipyard had closed. But the difference there was that when the shipyards closed, the car industry took off. So Volvo, Saab, they built up the car industry in the places where the shipyards closed. I think it was on the west side, Gothenburg. And so they managed to minimise all the unemployment. And there were lots of incentives given, to help protect the workforce. There's a country that, was one of the leading shipbuilding countries in Europe and now doesn't build ships, as far as I know. So it's sad that what's happening in the UK has already happened elsewhere. And it's the same problem, in a sense, that they can get the ships cheaper in Asia.
of course, the other thing that interests me, in terms of cultural practices and the arts, is that there are strong links, So there are songs of the sea, which are an essential part of the folk music of this country. And only very recently I was at an art exhibition, where a quite well-known artist who'd been in the Royal Navy during the war had been in Gosport drawing all the submarines. I had no idea about this at all. I'd never seen this work before, and it was extraordinary. And there is a kind of danger in terms of the relationship between local culture, local industry and work, and creative practice. There's a danger that if we turn ourselves into this kind of consumer-oriented industry, coffee shops and boutiques and things, it's not likely that that's going to produce any wonderful, long-lasting folk songs. I mean, they won't be folk songs, but, or poems. People are going to write poems about shopping on Amazon, for instance.
No, shops are good places to write poems.
To write them, yeah, but I don't know whether... poems about working in the call centre, can do it, but, how long it's going to survive. I'm not, it's not quite the same as climbing the rigging in Nelson's Navy, is it? I don't
know. Well, one man who's attempted to kind of capture the decline of Northeast shipbuilding is Sting. Gordon Sumner, I think he's called, but the man they call Sting. And his recent album came out at the end of last year, called The Last Ship. Robin, this is something you pointed us towards. It's a very interesting mix of things. It's a kind of stage show musical album. I think this is his first work for about 10 years, so he's kind of been off the radar. It's something you pointed us towards. I listened to it quite intensely, and I've got problems with it, but... Tell us a bit how you came to it and what you like about it.
I came to it from a slightly different angle. By chance, I was watching TV one night late, and it came on, the premiere in New York. I thought it was a bit of a strange place to premiere it, but I wondered what they made of the accents. But I see it as a drama. I'm not seeing it as Sting trying to put on, an even heavier accent. I think he's trying to recreate a world that has gone now up there. And so he was taking on with Jimmy Nail and the other people. I think the Unthanks are on it, who did the film about the songs of the shipyards. And he's trying to create a drama. So I saw it more as him playing a character, only he's singing it rather than being on a stage for the purposes of the CD. He's just
My problem with it is it's a very curious mix of things. I get the stage play and I get the character bit and I get him kind of taking on a persona, if you like, but he's kind of mixed it into sort of some of the things he normally does. Some of the songs on the album are great, and the one we're going to play is one of the good ones in my estimation. There's a song on the album, The Night the Pugilist Learned How to Dance. It's a beautiful, absolutely beautiful song, and Sting uses his voice to the best of its ability. Okay, great song. There are other things, Dead Man's Boots. It's a bit of a mix of shanty, country and western kind of stuff. My problem mostly, I think I'm kind of what I'm narrowing it down to, and it's a dangerous thing to say, and I should be clear, first of all, I have no problem with Geordies and no problem with the Geordie accent, but I really struggle with his kind of affected singing. I really struggle with his kind of the way he tries to convey the story, even though he's in character. I think he's almost kind of, dare I say, he's almost lampooning a kind of a Northeast accent. He's got Jimmy Nail involved, which I think you have to, by statute, I think. You mentioned the Unthanks, the Wilson family and Catherine Tickell and others. Brian Johnson from AC/DC is involved. Now, all of those people are good examples of people who use their voice and create a real kind of sense of kind of strong vocal range without a Geordie accent, without an accent of any kind. And it's, different parts of the brain, I know, are used to talk and to sing. And I just think, I'd wonder where Sting kind of wanted to go with this.
No, I just thought it was his tribute, really. I take your point that it's not his normal accent, it's stronger than that. But I think he's in character, and it's his tribute, really. And you do go back in time a little bit with it. It's not necessarily what you're going to hear on the streets today.
Maybe I was overly critical of our good friend Sting, and I'll let you be the judge of that, because now we're going to play the title track of the album, The Last Ship. You're listening to Towards the Point with me, James Sandy, Dave Allen, and our special guest, the poet Robin Bolam. And Robin, you were talking earlier on about responses to things happening, and a terrible thing in Australia, the kind of wild fires and the kind of bush fires. And you've written a piece kind of which relates to that. Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, it's a poem called Wildfire, and it's an attempt really to tackle it in a more positive way. But also, I'd been reading David Malouf's book, which was called Imagining Babylon. And in that, he has he's a poet who is also a writer. And he'd used this wonderful image of the fire, the forest fire, in a positive way, because, of course, he was stressing the fact that without the intense heat, then the seeds don't germinate. They don't, some of them just don't come to life. So it made me think of it in a different way, and I wrote something which is it's a love poem, but it's also about linking the fires in a into this relationship, but not focusing on the negative side for a change. And it's called Wildfire. Stay warm in my arms, you wrote, and their safe warmth gathered me in. If I try hard, I hear your heart as strongly as you once felt mine pulsing through a glow of skin. It's been months since we could touch, months before we'll meet again. The bush is lit with burning chains that ring and choke your summer air. I shiver in December rain. Yet in the dry husk of the night, I remake myself in flame to leap across a hemisphere, as if the seas were river wide and deserts only forest tracks. I need to know that you are safe. The warmth you made has kindled such an intense heat, it cracked the case and freed a seed sprung from us both to grow where fire winds let it root. The trees here stiffen white asleep. With you they burn. Trunks fizzing sap fall on each other in eager flames. Reach out your arms across charred ground. These fires will pass, but we will not.
That's great. And there is a real positivity to that, which lots of people think poetry is about doom and gloom, isn't it? But I'm a big fan of John Hegley. Have you, aware of John Hegley?
Yes.
That's poetry at kind of breakneck pace. So
often with a ukulele.
Often with a ukulele and a Hessian dog, which, you know, what other props do you need? Dave's looking at me blankly. Now, Robin, there's another piece you're going to read for us as well, which I think is called Whale Song.
Yes, we've been talking about responses, and you can respond to all sorts of things that concern you or you have passion about. And one of the things that I moved into for a while, which is, it still comes and goes, it's another thread, is the whole thing about climate change and what's happening to the natural world. I found I was writing about survival of people to start with, and now it's spread. And this was linked into some of the things that happened. There was a whale that sadly died when it got sort of tempted into the Thames estuary accidentally. This sort of thing, animals, fish being in strange places, is going to keep on happening, I think, because of the way the climate is. And this is also linking us into the problems that even such exotic, apparently exotic, creatures such as whales have, that somehow, you know, our flight to wherever we're going for our summer holiday might actually be contributing to the problem. Whale Song. Gulpers of light, the oceans you navigate evolve darkly. You change songs together, surfacing after each last theme to breathe. A skirt of sea fills with the same slow shift of male moans and trills. Cold drets cradle eerie scrapes and groans. Warmth brings confusion. Like the seasons, we could lose you in this mistiming. So let us not be stranded staring when a young baleen needs helping out of harbour, or one of her northern cousins can't swing out of an estuary, though his call is as loud as a jet on takeoff, and his four-chambered heart weighs as much as three humans. Every burning forest misdirects you, disrupts your feeding. Every journey we make now may swallow your song. Well, I'm also trying to finish another collection of poems. That's been taking my time up lately.
And so. Is that a hard process to kind of work what,
well, it is
out,
for me.
What's in and out?
Yes,
or?
I thought I had enough and then I kept throwing them out. So at the moment, I'm sort of probably halfway to two-thirds there.
You could have a whole separate collection of the things that you didn't want to put in.
I could.
There could be a theme through that.
That wouldn't be so good. Actually, that's the funny thing about it. It often doesn't... You think to yourself, I was quite happy with that poem, but it doesn't fit.
Mm.
And that's the worst of it. You want to put a collection together and somehow they've got to literally connect. And you end up over years, because I don't write quickly. It takes me quite a long time. I mean, say 2007 was the time, the last one. It was December 2007 when it came out. But that was quite a while ago. And then, of course, it takes a while, once you've had your poems accepted, to actually, you know, come out in a book form. But I find I end up doing different strands. Like I mentioned, the natural world poems. And there's also, at the moment, I've been doing quite a lot about the Northeast. And then there are more personal things. And they're all to do with survival of a sort. But trying to connect them is not so easy. And I think possibly the way I'm going now is to do with, you know, the sense of home and where people feel secure and, you know, different versions of the way home is interpreted, whether it's in terms of the world and the animal kingdom, or whether it's, you know, in a personal sense and local, you know, feeling of belonging locally. So that's probably what's going to be the connection in the end.
Well, we shall watch your work eagerly, and we'll keep tabs on you. And it's been great to have you back on the show.
Thank you.
And you're going to finish, I think, with a poem that I'm struggling to pronounce. But so you better explain a little bit about the title before anything else.
Well, it means home.
Home.
And there are different spellings of the word, and the way I've spelled it is H-Y-E-M, and it's yem.
Yem.
To me, it's like there's a Nordic and a Scandinavian generally pronunciation, which sounds very similar, which is a J instead of the Y. And if you're up in the Northeast and you, somebody says, you know, are you coming with us? And you say, no, I'm going, yeah.
I need to go back up there, see? I'm losing touch with the dialect.
It's like the Scottish, you know, I'm going here. What was it? I'm going hame. I'm not a Scot, so I can't.
Oh, yeah.
I think they'd say hame and we'd say some...
What do we say in Pompey, Dave?
Don't know, just go, I think.
We'll work on it.
Okay. Yem. When a place puts its hands round your heart, you feel a gentle grip, experience an inner lift of spirit, a smile that claims your face even when alone. A sinking sun falling on fields across the valley, the sense of space and peace as lives in scattered houses turn on lights along the river. Yem. Home. Where trains ran alongside shipyard cranes, until the morning one of them knocked our carriage off the line as its jib swung through the driver's cab. Yet after the screams through shattered glass, voices reassured. Firemen, who sounded like my dad, lifted us onto ladders, and Scotswood Road soothed by being dusty and noisy as it usually was. When the shipyards closed, cranes were last to go, sold to India, along with the dry dock. I wondered how they dealt with the shock of heat. Our sky was never the same again. Yet now in this southernmost county, cranes draw me to the water as I drive down to Bourbon Way, hoist my heart high enough to swing me over the estuary as if I'm travelling home.
Just before we go, we've just got time to catch up with our friends at Pine Vinyl to talk about some of the exciting things they've got coming up in April. April the 19th is Independent Record Store Day. They're doing a whole host of things, so I caught up with Steve Courtnell, and he gave me some exclusive lowdown.
We have got Oliver Wilde announced. That's really going to kick off our week. We're trying to make it a week-long event, and we have Oliver Wilde at the Square Tower on the 12th of April. So fantastic venue, really happy with that, and Ollie Wilde's a fantastic musician and should be a pretty big act, I think, this year. He's got a new album coming out in May, so get along to that. leading on to the week, we are showing our first pie and film night. So we're looking at showing a film, hopefully monthly, called Pie and Film, where essentially you watch a music-related film and eat pie whilst you do that. The first edition is linked into a Apple Store Day. It's going to be Last Shop Standing, the new updated edition. But we've also got the author of the book, Graham Jones, down to do a question and answer session afterwards, which will be, and this guy is a living, breathing, he claims to have been to more record shops than anyone else in the UK, and I certainly believe him. So it'd be nice for folks to come along and reminisce over some of the record shops that were open in Portsmouth, perhaps, that he would probably remember.
Is that just something people can turn up to, or is it ticketed?
It is, yeah. I'm actually, check your inboxes, there'll be a mail shop going out about it. Basically, to book your seat, you just have to place an order for a meal, and that's all you need to do. So you can email us at contact@pieandbowing.co.uk or call into the store to place your order. So that's it, really. There'll be some other surprises on the night as well. There'll be some interesting flavours of popcorn and things. So that's on the Wednesday night. On the Thursday, I can exclusively reveal Smoke Fairies will be doing an in-store performance. They're releasing their new album that week. So that's Thursday night. And on Friday and Saturday, I can also exclusively reveal that we are having the road closed for Record Store Day, and also combined with Castle Road Day. This springtime is going to be a two-day event on the Friday and the Saturday. So the whole road will be closed down. There will be bands playing on both days. On the Saturday, there will be some bigger artists which are yet to be announced, and also some artists playing from our label as well. So it's a whole week of events, and we're looking forward to it. So check your inboxes and look on our socials, and check out the posters and stuff as we announce the act playing for Record Store Day. But yeah, certainly start by coming to see young Oliver Wilde at the Square Tower. Should be a great show.
And there'll be more updates, I'm guessing, on the web, which is pieandvinyl.co.uk.
And if that's not enough, Dave, you've got a trio of events for people to catch up locally.
I have. I'll do them backwards, because the first one I've got is the next day, Sunday the 20th, which is, it's Easter weekend, isn't it?
It's a busy weekend.
And I'm playing at the Gosport Folk Festival, and since I don't know anybody else who's playing at the Gosport Folk Festival at that weekend, I'll mention my band and nobody else. But it is Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Easter weekend, Gosport Folk Festival, as usual, run by Shep Woolley.
Excellent.
And going back from there, the previous weekend is the launch of a book about mods. It's called Mods, the New Religion, and it will have a particular focus in part on Portsmouth, which is unusual because most mod books are about London. But this one is about mods in the regions as well. And it's a fabulous looking book, but written by Paul Anderson. And going back from that, Sunday the 6th of April, how could I miss it, given that we've had one or two prompts during the show, is the start of the English cricket season.
I knew you'd get it in there. And even going backwards, you've taken us forward as ever. Our thanks to Robin Boland for appearing on the show. My thanks to Dave Allen for his gaze on the world. I've been James Sandy, and Towards the Point is a King of the Buttons production for 93.7 Express FM.